Duże. Okay. First of all, I should like to thank the organizers for making this meeting possible, and in particular for inviting me here so that I can give this talk. Both. I am a
Speak louder.
This is just for the so you keep it and don't trust him.
It's okay, but
don't lie. Sorry.
But this is from the guy who makes the video. Mm-hmm. But for us, you should speak
louder. Oh, thank you very much for this explanation. Now I hope I can remember. The subject of my talk is selecting basic unconditional basic sequences. This is an important thing in Banach space theory for most of the time that I remember. That problem was wide open, and nobody knew how to do it in a general Banach space. Then, eventually, some 10 years ago, it was solved by Gowers and Morey, who were the first to construct a Banach space in which there is no unconditional basic sequence. Later, it was found out that those spaces have some other properties that would be very pathological from the earlier perspective, but perhaps now they are getting to be understood better, and they are just one class of spaces in which unconditional basic sequences do not exist. And as it was found later, established by Gowers, the existence of such spaces is the only obstacle in constructing unconditional basic sequences. If a Banach space does not contain such a bad subspace, then the construction of unconditional basic sequences is possible. And this is the content of a theorem known as Gowers' dichotomy theorem. That was originally obtained as some infinite game procedure, which would lead at the end to establishing whether a Banach space, given Banach space, contains such a bad subspace or no. And in the second case, would lead to construction of an unconditional basic sequence. And now, the approach that I am going to present is basically a variation of this game theoretic result, but it is arranged so that the games do not appear in the actual exposition, which may have some advantages. So the results, most of the results I will present are from this paper, which was written last year, but there are some last-minute additions too. Let me start with some notation and terminology I'm going to use. So, in a Banach space, X, isn't it? Where did you? Lens? This? It's better? Okay. X, I will occasionally use notation X to the n in parentheses as a set of linearly independent sequences in a Banach space X. Given such a sequence, and given any numerical sequence lambda I, there is a notation for the norm of the sequence as a multiplier. So lambda I may act as a multiplier on the set of linear combinations of the XIs. And if this action is a bounded operator with norm M, we say that this is the notation GX of lambda as the norm of the sequence of multipliers as a multiplier for this particular sequence Xi. So, of course, for this norm to be bounded, it is necessary that sequence lambda I should be bounded. So this is a natural restriction that it is taken from L infinity. And a sequence is said to be an unconditional basic sequence if there is a constant M such that this norm is bounded by L infinity norm. These are well-known concepts, just perhaps a different notation used as a shorthand here. So, given such a sequence Xi, by M sub Xi, one may denote, and I shall, the set of bounded multipliers lambda that act on it. And the sequence is then said to be unconditional if the each sequence in L infinity is a multiplier. This is actually a theorem. If every bounded sequence is a multiplier, then such an M exists. So this is simple. Now, it's again convenient to write as M sub X the union of all sequences of multipliers. So they are those sequences which are a multiplier for at least one vector sequence X. So normal way to formulate the Gauer's dichotomy theorem is that every Banach space X, infinite dimension, contains a subspace Y, which either contains an unconditional basic sequence or is hereditarily decomposable, which means that no subspace of Y is decomposable, which means that no subspace of Y is isomorphic to a direct sum of two infinite dimensional subspaces. I will considers as a result in this form. It's basically equivalent but more convenient for our purposes, and perhaps it illustrates some point. So here it's a characterization of those Banach spaces in which every subspace contains an unconditional basic sequence. So the first condition says exactly this. Every subspace Y of X contains a sequence Xi, which is an unconditional basic sequence. The second condition is the one which was considered by Gauers. Namely, in my language, it says that a sequence of alternating sequence plus and minus one is a multiplier. Is a multiplier for some sequence in every subspace Y of X. So, and finally, the third condition here is that for every subspace Y of X, there is at least one bounded sequence which is in M sub Y without being convergent, without being the space little c. So these three properties of X are equivalent. And if X contains no unconditional unconditional basic sequences, then in fact no sequence lambda which is not in C may be say there is, it has a subspace in which no such sequence is a bounded multiplier. All bounded multipliers are just of the form a constant plus a sequence tending to zero.
Can you put down M by again?
Yeah, it's over there. Oh, sorry. Over here. M sub, yes, okay. So this is just the union. Those sequences lambda which are...
Some sign maybe belong to multiplier of one C and another belong to multiplier of another C.
That's okay.
And that anyway it is compared...
It is not a linear space, it is just a set.
I know. But so...
It's a set. When I say that minus 1 to the n belongs, it means that just for some sequence, there is a decomposable subspace. Okay? So it simplifies, actually, when you just get used to this way of thinking. Now, the implication of going from 3 to 2 and from 2 to 1 are obvious. Really, the important implication is 2 implies 1, and I will concentrate on this. This is the same implication as in the Gower's theorem. Here is some explanation why is that, but it should be basically clear. Actually, as stated, 2 implies 1 says slightly more because it says that you get an unconditional basic sequence in every subspace y of x, but it's just in the nature of it. So it follows formally from Gower's statement. So I'm going to present a proof of this implication 2 implies 1. And for this purpose, let me recall the definition of the unconditional unconditionality constant of a sequence. This, which will be denoted by UC of Xi or the complex unconditionality constant. Then consider such a function G sub X, which is only a gauge on numerical sequences. For a multiplier, we ask what is its best norm if you think of it as a multiplier for all possible linearly independent sequences in X. So this is G sub X. So this gives you a function on set of subspaces. And using this notation, it is possible to state the implication 2 implies 1 in the quantitative form. Here I just specify two multipliers. One is this alternating one, minus 1 to the n. And for the complex case, one can take just a sequence, a complex sequence U, which is dense in the unit circle, and each value has infinite multiplicity. With these vectors, we can say that in the real case, the best choice of the for a sequence Xi is to have get unconditionality constant basically as small as this number. So if we can just ask how good multiplier is the sequence alternating sequence M, and then up to epsilon one can obtain a basic sequence, unconditional basic sequence with this constant. In the complex case, again, this one sequence tells you how good unconditionality constant you can obtain. And if you don't care so much about unconditionality, you prefer a simpler proof, then it turns out using this same sequence as in the real case, plus minus 1 to the n, you can obtain unconditionality constant up to factor 2. And these estimates are optimal. For instance, in a situation where this function is g sub x is constant, then actually you have equality. So the approach I will present is always automatically quantitative and gives the best constants from this. And I should just mention that the analogous theorems are also true in the context of operator spaces, where the norm of operators is considered is replaced by a completely bounded norm. Same approach works, just there is simply some property of this norm is verified, which is basically done in a very similar way as it is in the case of that we know well. Now, some notation. In an infinite dimensional Banach space, G of X will be the set of closed linear subspaces of X, the Grassmann set. And there are two important subsets, finite dimensional subspaces and infinite dimensional subspaces of X, which are will be denoted this way, G sub finite and G sub infinite. Now, there is a crucial concept which will be introduced, and it is of plentiful sets in X. And it is very important to have this concept. If we just choose inductively a sequence of vectors x1, x2, so on, and which are supposed to be consecutive vector of an unconditional basic sequence, then we would like to make sure that at each step we have lots of ways to choose this x, xn. And then after the choice, again, the set there will be more restrictions, but again, the set will be big. And this is the concept of largeness of this set is here is this of plentiful sets. Subset S of a Banach space is said to be plentiful in X if in every infinite dimensional subspace Y there is a further infinite dimensional subspace Z which is contained in S. So in this this specifies that how big is the set. So the important thing is that if you intersection of such two plentiful sets is plentiful, it's clear. And so also finite intersections are. Now, there are some operations on Grassmann sets, which we shall use. One is the possibility of adding subspaces. The sum of finite dimensional subspaces of X form an abelian semigroup with respect to the natural addition. Also, it is possible to say this algebraic sum of a finite dimensional space and an infinite dimensional space of X is still a closed infinite dimensional subset of X. So There is a well-defined action of finite-dimensional subspaces on infinite-dimensional subspaces. By this, to each u, we correspond e plus u. Very simple, of course. Then we'll need the product powers of these semigroups. Case power. Actually, if you just think of the context of Gower's result, k equals 2 is sufficient. But it is makes no difference to in complexity to consider the arbitrary powers, and there are applications where you need them. This is a notation for the neutral element. And here is some example, say some one operation which will be important very soon. A vector of a k tuple of infinite dimensional of any subspaces, if it is given, and if a vector w is given, this notation is used to denote an analogous k-tuple in which on the i-th coordinate we add one-dimensional line determined by w. So this is in formulas. We just change the i-th component by this augmentation, and the remaining ones are stay the same. Also, we shall need topology on the set of finite dimensional spaces, and it is just defined by the Hausdorff metric. It's a familiar thing, of course. B sub Z is here the closed unit ball of the space Z. Important thing is that if Banach space X is separable, then this Grassmann set of finite dimensional subspaces is also separable. It's a standard fact. So now I can describe what are phi stable spaces and how one can select sequences in such spaces. So first, phi is any function on the k-th power of the Grassmann set, say with values in one infinity including. Here we assume just that it is monotone in the sense that if we are given two k-tuples, u and v, then, and one is contained in the other, then we have the estimate for the values. Okay. Then there is a very important but simple operation, which uses the concepts we had before, those algebraic sums. This is to the function phi, we associate function phi tilde. And this one has different arguments. Now, the first argument is a k-tuple of finite dimensional spaces, something like which I denote here, such k-tuple E. The second argument is an infinite dimensional subspace of Y. I look here, to define it, I look at the set of values of phi, where to each E sub I in this first k-tuple, I can add infinite dimensional subspace, but not of X, but of Y. Then we take infimum of these things. So far, let me say it's absolutely general, and this definition is general too. X is said to be phi stable if this function phi tilde does not depend on the second argument. It means that you say if typically a Banach space may not be phi stable, but what you expect is that if you take its subspaces, then this phi tilde will somehow have a smaller oscillation. And in the limit, if you take something which is has a small, arbitrary small oscillation, it will have oscillation zero, and it will be stable. So this is what we want. And we show that actually such stable sequences exist under very weak conditions on phi. So this is all about this definition. Now, how it is used. So this is a lemma. We start with a stable space X, and we just assume that for one pair of arguments E and X, the function phi tilde is satisfies this condition, is less than a number d. Then we try to augment this E by choosing a vector W and adding this, adjoining on each possible place here. From I can be from 1 to k. So this is the operation I had before. K tuple of finite dimensional spaces can be augmented at for each I. And the assertion is that in this way, this condition on W defines a plentiful set. There are plentifully many such W's for each I, so there are also plentifully many of those which are such for every I at the same time. So this is a very simple idea, which is responsible for the fact that when we when we construct the basis and up to some moment we have some conditions satisfied, later we should consider conditions which are necessary at next stage, and they will still tell that you have huge sets, because this lemma allows you to pass to more and more vectors. The proof is very simply just relies on checking the definition. So one takes a subspace Y, N in G infinity. D is also a fixed number, to make sure. Using this condition, here, phi stability is used to make this assertion. From the assumption that in X, for X, this value was less than D, we obtain that it is less than D for Y, because simply this phi tilde for Y is the same as for X. But since when you know this for Y, then it means that you can find this K tuple U in G sub infinity of Y to the K. And once you have them, then you should consider those extensions. And why is this estimate true for this extension W? I mean, it is not true for any vector W, lowercase w in X, but it is true for many of them. Why is this? This value of phi tilde, by the definition of phi tilde as an infimum, is estimated by this value without tilde. Okay? Now, simply this argument, as it is written, is exactly the same as E plus U, provided that W is in U sub I. Okay? So when these things are equal, and this one was assumed to be less than D. So also this is less than D. Okay. So this set of W, which satisfies this condition, is plentiful. Why? In a given Y, we picked U sub I, for which this is okay. And Y was arbitrary, and in arbitrary Y, we found U sub I, which is infinite dimensional. That's all. So this is a very simple principle. Now, the selection of the bases, it's very simple. We start with the basis, with the space X, which is assumed to be phi stable. And in the beginning, we start with the zero dimension, zero subspaces. This it just means that no vectors have been fixed yet. And the assertion is that there is a basic sequence Xi with a prescribed basis constant eta, which has the property that if you define for each of such k tuples, E sub f, defined by a partition function f, you have estimates of these numbers by d. So it is possible for when you have no vectors because of this assumption. So this whole number tells, which is known in the beginning, tells you how good result can be at the end. And this sequence is, of course, constructed by induction. There are plentiful sets which describe the conditions which all these. So there are, as long as there are finitely many conditions for each n, intersections are non-empty and the choice is possible. So this is a standard way. So each new vector of the basis is must be chosen so that the spaces E sub f, which can be defined after arbitrary partitioning of the first n vectors into k subsets and taking linear spans, must be less than d. And this is just application of the previous step. So if they are satisfy such a condition before the choice of xn, then there are lots of choices of xn, plentifully many, which satisfy all the conditions we need. Provided, because there are only finitely many partitions of the sets of n elements into k subsets. So this procedure can, of course, be applied if one has... here it was applied for some function phi, but if there are infinitely many functions that perhaps defined on various powers of the Grassmann set, still everything can be done, but this requires some condition that... it is like if you impose new conditions, there should always be only finitely many which apply for given n. So some new conditions may be of the form that the basic sequence you construct only from some place satisfies additional condition. It is like in Cyrilson's construction. You know that when you want to split vectors into n subsets, the subsplittings are allowed, provided that you start after the nth element. And this is exactly what appears here. So it is possible to apply this to construction of such bases with infinitely many conditions, and this is the theorem which says it technically. This is the end of that explanation for infinitely many, case of infinitely many such norms. Now let me pass to existence of such stable subspaces. Again, the principle is very simple. There is a concept which is relevant, which is of partially ordered sets, in which countable chains are bounded. So this means that for every non-decreasing sequence S sub I in the set, there is an element in the set which bounds the sequence from above. And let me recall that the definition of cofinal sets, subsets, subset is cofinal if for every element in the subset in the set, there is something in the subset which is bigger. Now, stability in our context is the property which is studied for functions defined on a product. T may be any set, and S is an ordered set. Stable elements of the S are those for which it has the property that if you pick an element which is greater than given S, then the two functions of T are identical. And now this is the lemma which is fundamental here. If you assume that this function that S is an ordered, partial ordered space with the CCB condition, and T is a separable topological space, and phi is a function which, as for each fixed S, is non-decreasing, and for each fixed T is non-decreasing in S, and for each fixed S is continuous in T, then this set is cofinal. So there exist elements which are stable. The function does not depend on the first argument. On the second argument. And this is a very simple lemma once it is stated. Case when T has just one element, it is simply the definition of CCB. If T is countable, then it is a countable iteration. You find an element S1 so that it does not depend of T0. Then you find a larger element S2 so that it does not depend on T1. For fixed T1. For fixed T1 does not depend on anything. And then in this way, using the countable you apply this countably many times and you find some element which is larger, and in the general case just you use a separability assumption. It can be chosen for a dense subset, countable subset T prime, and using continuity one obtains this assertion. Once we know this lemma, it is true then. You can get as formal consequences that actually there could be countably many such functions phi sub I if they satisfy those conditions. There are then elements which are stable for each of those functions, and it reduces to the previous formulation and follows formally. Now, why such functions, why this lemma is useful for Banach spaces? There is one canonical important example of spaces with CCB condition which is related with a Banach space. This is the partial order of infinite dimensional subspaces, which is, I mean, sort of reversed ordering. In this sense, y is, does not exceed z if and only if z is a subset of y up to finite dimensional subspace. This, with this partial ordering, the Grassmann set of infinite dimensional subspaces satisfies CCB. And this is the abstract formulation of a well-known diagonal principle. Okay? So the proof is like that you simply take intersections y sub n of consecutive x sub i's. Those intersections are infinite dimensional because each time you have they are almost contained up to finite dimension, so the intersection is still infinite dimensional. Once they are infinite, but y sub n are actually decreasing, not up to finite many vectors, finite dimension, but they are decreasing. So you can pick a linearly independent sequence y sub n, so that. Are in those decreasing subspaces. Y sub n belongs to capital Y sub n. And then the closed linear span Y of the sequence has the required property, which is just consequence of obvious things. Now, this lemma is then everything. If we want to construct basic unconditional basic sequences, we just have to tell what functions phi we use, because so far everything was done without specifying the function phi. And the simplest function phi to use is, in the Gower's case, it's like norm x minus y. As a function of x and y, or norm x minus y, this is roughly exactly. I assume it can be stated like this here. Banach space X is given, and we have a function h on the product, and here two functions are defined, h with up arrow and h with down arrow. One is, you consider the supremum of the function, given that the sum of the arguments has norm 1, and another is the infimum. And then, this is the simplest case, is if you start with exactly this function, which takes x pair x1, x2 to the norm of the difference, and this will be the function which, when plugged into that lemma, produces unconditional basic sequences. Another example uses unconditional norms. If you have an unconditional norm Q on RK and use this function H sub Q, then leads to another pair of functions. What is important about those functions? So one thing is that The first function in the Gower's case, which I denote as phi sub plus minus, satisfies. This is the best. It can be defined by this estimate. The best constant, which makes this estimate true for every u sub 1 in capital U sub 1 and U sub 2 in capital U sub 2. Then there is a. There is another definition of a function which corresponds to multipliers, lambda I. And then this is a function phi denoted this way, which is used if you want to obtain bases with lower Q estimates. And for upper P estimates, you use this other with infimum. Now, after these functions are defined, the only thing which you need to apply them, to apply the stability results and then to which allows you to obtain basic unconditional basic sequences, is the verification of the hypothesis. And there were two assumptions on the function phi tilde there. It had to be monotone in one argument and it had to be continuous in the other argument. And here, for this function, this actual monotonicity is simple. And so everything really reduces to the proof of continuity. So this is one topological assertion. And this is the only... say these things are... I presented quite slowly, but they were, say they were really very simple and short. Only continuity requires some effort. Not big effort, but... it's the only part where there are really some computations. I didn't explain... In the complex case, when I wanted to obtain optimal unconditionality constant for complex scalars, one uses this function, which corresponds to a choice of a multiplier lambda. And how does this work and why it is necessary to consider higher powers of the Grassmann sets? If you want to obtain the estimate for unconditionality constant in which you have, so for real spaces, I mean, once you have it for plus minus one sequences, you have it for all bounded sequences. But in the complex case, there are more extreme points than in the unit for the unit ball in the field of scalars. There are uncountably many. Still, if you, for instance, pick n points equidistant on the circle, and you obtain the estimate for unconditionality in which sequences, multipliers, lambdas are just from that group of case root, then it will approximate very well actual constant, provided that k is big. And on the other hand, I mean, if you use a fixed number of points on the circle, then there are only finitely many functions on each step lambda. So these things do apply. Very easy. As, given an epsilon, you can then pick just how many you use. And everything then is controlled by that one norm of that multiplier, which I called U in the beginning, which had a dense sequence in the unit circle repeated infinitely many times. So there is, say, something which... I did not perhaps emphasize when you consider this f- condition of monotonicity with respect to this special order introduced for Banach spaces, this order does not distinguish between two spaces which differ just by finitely many dimensions. So the function should take the same value for such pair of spaces. And if your function depends on something like the angle between two infinite dimensional subspaces, which is in the or some generalized angle between k infinite dimensional subspaces, and you want to make this optimal, then somehow it is harder to obtain such estimate with the spaces somehow restricted to be contained in a fixed subspace. But if it is just in a subspace of finite codimension, then you obtain the same estimates. So it is the fact that, say, in the Gauer's case, you have just two constant multipliers. It is in this case, it gives you something which asymptotically just behaves nicely after passing to finite codimension, do not change. But working directly with multipliers, which are more complicated, doesn't work that way. So those functions, they are not quite continuous in because they do have monotonicity properties, but these things somehow are well taken care of in that instruction. I should finish now. I didn't have time eventually to show how this continuity is proven, but actually there are some very simple principles involved, and say probably there would be more examples than what I have here. I cannot think of ones at the moment. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? I just have a comment. If the space has a C-infinitesimus node, then it does contain C0 over D. This is a theorem of Lebesgue.
Here that it would be interesting to use this approach in this era, actually improving this theorem rather than if I know that we encounter very similar problems. This may help in this era. There are still quite a few open problems around Robert Debye's theorem. So I would be really interested in seeing to apply this approach.
Can we thank
you? Yeah, of course, it's nice and interesting that you have a very general scheme which later can give many results which a priori do not seem to be the same. But for the historical correctness, I would like to mention that after Gauss's dichotomy theorem, in the case of unconditional basis, the first proof which did not use games and things like this was done by Moret, and it was
yes in the volume, MSRI
in the MSRI volume, and in fact this approach is very similar in a sense to what Moret did. And his approach, on the other hand, he was saying that it resembles Galvin-Prikri-Shikri approach to Ramsey theorem. So.
Okay.
Yes.
If I have a question to help you to memorize the talk, perhaps it's a little bit in the direction of the point of Prikri. Just, is it correct for me to see your approach as such kind of logical extract, or logical envelope, perhaps, from combinatorial approach of Gauss? Because I just forgot details, but it looks that many steps complicated because they were done in concrete situations.
Yes.
They just take logical extract, which perhaps after applied.
Yes, that is very much somehow. These are the same arguments, but differently arranged. The comparison is like this, that, say, in Gower's case, I mean, you can think that there is a game between one person that chooses vectors and another who insists that, stipulates that they must, further one must be in some subspace. And now it is not clear, given such a game, it's not clear who will win. In this approach, say, first, some preliminary work is done to pick a subspace, and then it is obvious that from the very beginning that one must win or lose. Simply, given a subspace, there is some number, which is something which I started with was phi tilde of 0, x, and the space is stable. And now this number is sort of the value of the game. If you pick any number which is just a bit larger, then it is automatical. With this approach, you can as good unconditional basic sequence. Anything which is just a bit larger. Anything which is smaller is just impossible. And this is known from the very beginning. This number is... it's just something defined in terms of this one multiplier, for instance, multiplier U or M. It involves nothing more. And tells you exactly how good basic sequences can be. There is no game, because somehow the result is predetermined.
So in a sense, what you're saying is actually your proof determines the winning strategy in some sense.
The strategy is determined, but it simply says that you know in advance who will win.
Yeah, right. So which means that you determine a winning strategy.
Yeah, in particular. Yeah. In particular, but the game is not so interesting.
Yeah, of course, once you know a winning strategy, the game is interesting.
Yes.
That's true.
No, it is more important, in fact, what Tadek said. It was complicated combinatorics, and for every case, you have to invent another combinatorics. Instead of this, there exists some kind of logic which in finite dimensional theory should know, and which will do automatically many things.
Yes.
And this logic was... Nobody was brave enough to do this before the first example on trivial was put on the table. And now it is done. And now it is
part of the... I yes.
Just one comment. Gower's combinatorial theorem applies, it's much, much broader than
yes. That is true.
I mean, now what I am saying is really what Morel was saying.
Yeah, but this
was much, but let me finish. It was much broader. Now, Morel's approach applied only for the unconditionality. Now, how is it here? Can you do the whole combinatorial theorem of Gower's for large sets and so on? Can you do it here?
Not here.
Comment to me. I will tell you. But in the dimensional Banach space theory, not good in this combinatorics, which Gower's happened to be good. But whatever logical element were presented here, it's standard games in this theory, so it's much better put to this auditorium. This is what I want to say. It's correct logic instead of complicated and, how to say, in Hebrew, the combinatorics doesn't belong to the
theory. I completely agree with you about this. But I am saying that Gower's theorem, the game approach, was much more general.
So first, I cannot do it here. Secondly, I haven't tried yet. Third, I may be afraid that this is too much above my head. But on the other hand, what I wanted to say is that for some simple but important situation in Banach space theory like this, what I had preferred all the time was to have something which is basically simple, applies, and contains all those. If we don't want to learn too much, then this is the minimum that serves some purpose.
Okay.
Other questions? Let's speak again.